The following audiobook contains AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Attention Residue, the Latch Loop for Sustainable Productivity. Topic Introduction. It is 9 in the morning, in a city apartment, an office tower somewhere else in the world, and the day seems to begin with a plan. One person opens a blank document and takes a breath before the real work starts. Then a chat alert flashes, a meeting shifts, a colleague wants a quick update. A calendar invite lands before the first thought has settled. By the time the first hour ends, the person is busy, but the important work has barely moved.
That small collapse is so common that it can feel personal. It can look like a discipline problem, a motivation problem, even a character problem. But the larger truth is usually less flattering to modern work and more useful to understand. The day is often being designed to fragment. Attention is being asked to restart over and over before it has a chance to gather speed. This book lives in that ordinary tension. It is for the manager trying to protect deep thinking between meetings, the designer who keeps getting pulled into message threads, the analyst who cannot seem to finish a hard draft, the remote worker whose home and office now share the same walls, and the team lead who feels responsible for everyone's speed except their own. Their situations differ, but the pattern is the same. Messages, meetings, and tools keep multiplying. The work that matters most keeps getting postponed until the evening, when energy is lower and the mind is already crowded. That crowding has a name. Attention residue is what remains when part of the mind stays attached to the last task, the last message, or the last decision, even after the next task has begun. It explains why a quick glance at a thread is rarely just a glance. It also explains why switching feels cheaper than it is. The mind pays a restart cost every time it moves from one demand to another. On paper, the shift looks small. In lived experience, it can hollow out an entire afternoon. The deeper pressure is not just distraction. It is cognitive load, the amount of mental effort required to hold goals, decisions, unfinished tasks, and context in working memory at the same time. When that load climbs, even strong performers begin to feel slower, flatter, and less clear. They are still trying, but they are trying inside a system that keeps making thinking more expensive.
What makes this topic urgent is that modern work often rewards visible responsiveness more than invisible concentration. A quick reply can be praised. A quiet hour of focused thought can go unnoticed. Yet the work that changes products, decisions, writing, strategy, and care usually needs uninterrupted attention. The paradox is simple and frustrating. The more a person tries to stay available to everything, the less available they become to the thing that actually matters.
At the center of this book is a practical framework called the Latch Loop. The name matters because the problem is not simply managing time. It is learning what to latch onto, what to keep from sliding away, and how to let the day close without dragging unfinished mental noise into the night. The loop begins with meaningful work, moves through attention protection, then turns toward recovery and a clean ending. Each part depends on the others. If anyone is missing, the whole day becomes easier to fracture. So the first question is not, how can more be crammed in? It is, what deserves protection? That shift sounds small, but it changes the shape of the workday. Instead of treating every task as equally urgent, the listener begins to see the difference between true priorities and the constant weather of incoming requests. A focus project is one way the book gives that difference a usable form. A focus project
is a bounded piece of meaningful work, something with a clear edge, a clear purpose, and a next step that can actually be started. It is not a wish, and it is not a pile of scattered tasks. It is something the mind can enter on purpose.
The same discipline applies to communication. Email, chat, meetings, and calendar changes are not the enemy. They are necessary. But left unmanaged, they become the hidden operating system of the day. A message that feels harmless in the moment can leave a residue that follows the listener back to the page, the spreadsheet, or the decision that was already hard enough. The book explores how friction, urgency, and channel choice shape that experience, and why not every incoming note deserves the same speed or the same kind of reply.
Then there is the fatigue that arrives before the work is finished. That, too, is easy to misunderstand. It can feel like weakness, but it is often a design signal. It says the day has asked too much of the mind for too long, without enough recovery between demands. Some tasks belong to high-capacity moments. Others can be done when energy is lower. If the listener can tell the difference, the day stops feeling like a single blunt instrument and starts becoming something more intelligent.
And then comes the question that many productivity systems avoid until the very end. How does the day stop? In many workplaces, it does not. It leaks into the evening, into the next morning, into the weekend, and into the background of home life. Open loops keep monitoring the mind. Unfinished threads keep whispering. The workday remains psychologically present even after the laptop closes. This book treats that problem seriously, because a day that never ends cannot be sustainable, no matter how efficient it looks on a dashboard. What follows is not a promise of perfect control. It is an invitation to see work more clearly, to notice where attention leaks, to recognize how communication can either protect or consume the day, to understand why energy rises and falls, to treat recovery as part of the system, not a reward for surviving it, and to discover that a clean ending is not a luxury. It is part of how good work becomes repeatable.
There is a reflective question underneath everything here. If the day is shaped by what repeatedly interrupts it, then who is really in charge of the work? The answer is not as simple as locking every door or silencing every device. The answer is a little more human and a little more demanding. It requires choosing what matters, protecting the conditions that let it happen, and learning how to stop before the unfinished day starts following you home.
That is the doorway this audiobook opens. Not into a fantasy of endless focus, but into a more realistic way to work. One that respects attention, energy, and the need to begin again tomorrow. End of introduction. Your morning begins with a plan. You sit down, ready to start the work that matters most. Then a chat alert lands, a meeting moves, someone asks for a quick status update, and another request pulls you into a different tool. Half an hour later, you are busy, but the important work has barely started. That collapse is easy to misread as a discipline problem. More often, it is a design problem. Sustainable productivity is not about squeezing more tasks into the same tired hours. It is the capacity to do high-quality work without spending the day inside messages, meetings, and tool switching, and without carrying unfinished work into the evening. Once you see the day that way, the villain is not laziness. It is a work structure that keeps asking your attention to start over. Attention is finite. Every shift between goals, tools, or mental models has a restart cost. You do not move from a proposal to a chat thread and back as cleanly as it feels. Part of your mind stays attached to the message, the decision, or the unfinished reply. That lingering attachment is attention residue,
and it helps explain why even a brief check can slow the next stretch of thinking.
Recent workplace reporting describes knowledge workers switching screens or applications hundreds of times per day. The result is not just lost minutes, it is a day that loses shape. In Asana's 2026 global survey of more than 10,000 knowledge workers, employees reported that about 60% of working time went to work about work, like unnecessary meetings, duplicate work, status chasing, shifting priorities, and tool switching. In other words, much of the day was spent coordinating work rather than doing the core skilled work.
Other workplace reporting describes a related pattern as the infinite workday, where work routinely extends into early mornings and late evenings. It also describes a common backdrop for that extension, with interruptions, overlapping communication channels, and unclear priorities pushing focused work later and later. Separate team benchmarks reinforce the same direction. Teams that protect more uninterrupted focus time tend to perform better, even when overall workloads are similar. Taken together, these patterns point to structure, not willpower.
That is the setting for the latch loop this book uses to make sustainable productivity practical. You choose meaningful work, protect attention, recover energy, and close the day cleanly. The order matters. If you do not decide what deserves your best attention, everything can claim it. If you do not protect that attention, recovery gets postponed until exhaustion makes the choice for you. The first half of the loop begins with a smaller question than most productivity systems ask. Not what can you fit in, what is worth protecting? Instead of carrying a long wish list through the week, you choose one or two outcomes that matter enough to deserve focus time. Those outcomes become focus projects.
A focus project is not a vague aspiration, and it is not a pile of unrelated tasks. It is a bounded unit of meaningful work. You give it a shape your mind can hold. The simplest way to do that is with a focus project sentence. You name the outcome, the specific piece of work, why it matters, and the first edge around scope. This kind of sentence forces clarity. It separates the real objective from the fog that usually surrounds it. It also turns a broad ambition into something you can enter on purpose.
Good scope has two qualities. It is finishable, meaning the work has a window, a clear edge, and a version you can complete or pause without losing the thread. It is also restartable, meaning your notes, files, and next actions are set up so returning later does not require a long reorientation. The point is not perfection. The point is reducing the cost of beginning again. That is why each focus project needs a first physical next step. Open the draft. Pull the data. List the decision that must be made. Prepare the workspace. The action should be small enough to begin immediately and concrete enough that you do not have to negotiate with yourself. Then you add one more boundary that matters just as much. What counts as done enough for today?
Without that edge, the project expands until it fills the available energy, and stopping starts to feel like failure. With that edge, you preserve momentum and make the next block easier to re-enter. Now, protect the work on the calendar. The first focus block is not spare time left over after everything else. It is the appointment that keeps the rest of the day from swallowing the week. Clear next actions help here because they cut restart friction. When you return to the project, you do not have to rebuild the task from memory. You look at the next action and begin.
Choosing meaningful work solves only part of the problem. The second pressure point is communication. Email, chat, calendar updates, and meetings are necessary. The issue is that they can turn coordination into the main job if they arrive with the same priority and the same speed as your best thinking. A quick check feels harmless because it is brief, The cost shows up later when part of your attention stays attached to the thread you just opened. So the goal is not to eliminate communication. It is to add enough friction that communication stops becoming the day's operating system.
Start by separating messages by intent before you decide on a channel or a response speed. Some are urgent. Some are time-sensitive, but not interrupt-now urgent. Some need collaboration. Some are mostly informational. These categories do not remove judgment, but they stop every incoming note from masquerading as an emergency. Then set receiving rules. Decide which alert streams stay active, which are muted, and how a true urgent issue gets escalated. Without an escalation path, ordinary channels start carrying urgent needs. With every alert turned on, focus disappears. Sending rules matter too. Batch outbound messages when you can. Consolidate multiple questions into one clear request. Use clear subject labels that indicate the kind of response people should prepare. Send fewer partial updates that create new rounds of clarification. These choices are communication friction rules. They add just enough delay and clarity for genuine urgency to get through, without letting every message behave like an emergency. Give communication a reliable place in the day by tying response windows to energy. Focus work usually needs your clearest attention. Routine replies, status checks, and scheduling often do not. When communication has its own window, it stops colonizing every hour. That makes it possible to pair your highest impact focus projects with meeting-free or chat-free blocks instead of hoping silence appears on its own. Meetings deserve their own governance because they are one of the fastest ways to turn a day into fragments. Before you accept an invitation, ask what purpose the meeting serves, who holds the decision rights, who truly needs to attend, and what the collective time cost will be. If those answers stay vague, the cost is real, even when the invitation sounds small. Experiments with protected meeting-free days suggest that even a single meeting-free day can improve autonomy, communication quality, engagement, job satisfaction, and stress, along with productivity. The caution matters as well. Too little coordination creates new problems. The point is not zero meetings. The point is using meetings where they add value and protecting the rest of the week from automatic scheduling. A short availability statement can help make these rules visible. You can tell people when you usually respond, which channel to use for urgent matters, and when deeper work is protected. That reduces the guesswork that drives repeated pings. When new messages arrive, run them through a simple triage path. Answer now if it fits the window. Park it for the next response window if it does not. Convert it into a task if it needs action. Delegate when appropriate. Ask for clarification when the intent is unclear. Then, after the window closes, do one more small thing that pays off all day. Shut the message window, capture any new obligations, and re-enter the focus project through the next physical action. That quick reset prevents communication from lingering as unfinished mental noise. Technology can make all of this easier and harder at the same time. Unified communication platforms can reduce coordination friction by keeping chat, files, and updates in one place. Generative artificial intelligence tools can summarize threads, draft routine messages, and speed up some documentation. But tools that make communication easy can also increase its volume, widen reachability, and raise expectations for immediate response. Efficiency at the tool level does not automatically protect attention at the human level. Protection still comes from rules, boundaries, and scope. Picture a common workday. Several overlapping requests arrive from different people. Instead of treating each one as a separate emergency, consolidate the overlap into one focus project. Give yourself one response window for the related questions, then protect one block of time to move the actual work forward. The day may still be busy, but it no longer has to be shapeless. There is a center to it. You can test this with a 2-minute practice. choose one meaningful outcome for this week. Write one sentence that defines the focus project. Name the first physical next action. Mute one non-urgent alert stream. Then ask yourself a useful question. Which meaningful outcome and which communication friction rule would reduce the most context switching this week?
Next, the loop shifts from protecting attention to protecting energy, with a shutdown ritual that keeps work from following you past the official stop time. In Asana's 2026 global survey of more than 10,000 knowledge workers, employees described workdays filled with interruptions, shifting priorities, and constant coordination. That kind of day can feel like it is draining you personally, but the mechanism is often more practical than character or willpower. Now the focus shifts from attention to wear and tear.
Picture a foggy late morning. The hard task is open, but you keep circling easier work. By evening, you feel used up, and the one thing that mattered most barely moved at all. Inside the day, that can feel like a discipline problem. Often, it is something else. The day has asked you to hold too much, switch too often, and keep too many unfinished threads alive at once.
Mental fatigue is not a verdict on your character. It is a design signal. It tells you that the current mix of demands, transitions, and recovery is costing more than it returns. Cognitive load is the mental effort required to hold goals, decisions, context, and unfinished tasks in mind at the same time. If you are trying to draft and also tracking a follow-up and keeping a meeting change in view, your mind is trying to run several tracks at once.
That crowding leaves less room for careful thinking. It also makes task switching more expensive. Each switch asks you to inhibit one thread and activate another. Once or twice, the cost is manageable. Repeated across a day, it becomes one of the quiet drivers of fatigue. You usually feel that fatigue before you can explain it, as tiredness, lower motivation, and weaker performance on work that requires sustained attention or careful control. Recent workplace reporting describes the underlying conditions in plain terms. Many employees and leaders describe work as chaotic, shaped by interruptions, overlapping channels, and unclear priorities. That does not explain every tired afternoon, but it does match what cognitive load predicts when transitions and context holding become routine.
Research on knowledge worker energy points in the same direction. Energy is tied to stress, worry, daily habits, and how effective a person feels at work. In longitudinal research, perceived work effectiveness is the factor that rises and falls with energy over time. When you can see meaningful progress, energy tends to hold steadier. When the day breaks into fragments, effort can stay high, while energy drops anyway. You work all day, and the day still feels thin.
That is why a simple capacity check can be more useful than a heroic plan. At predictable points in the day, you pause long enough to label your current state as high capacity, medium capacity, or low capacity. The label takes only a moment. It gives you a signal to work with. Instead of asking your inbox what deserves your best attention, you ask what your present capacity can actually support.
High capacity windows are for deep thinking, problem solving, and other work that needs a steady line of thought. Medium capacity windows are better for practical execution, like routine writing, coordination, or updating a shared system. Low capacity windows are for low stakes administration, light sorting, and tasks that matter but do not need your sharpest mind. This is not rigid scheduling. It is a way to keep moving without pretending that every hour arrives with the same mental conditions.
Capacity matching is also a reminder that fatigue changes what the right task means. Another drain comes from unfinished obligations that keep tapping you on the shoulder. An open loop is anything unresolved that your mind still thinks it has to monitor. If you leave it there, it competes with the work in front of you. Open loop capture is the practice of writing it down so working memory does not have to hold it in place. Once the item is out of your head, you sort it. Is it an action you can take, a waiting point that depends on someone else, a decision to return to, a reference note to store, or a request to decline? The point is not to build a perfect system. The point is to stop renegotiating the same unfinished thing every time it resurfaces. The same principle helps when you move from one task to another. A micro transition is a short handoff between threads. You close the previous thread, note its status, name the next action, and pause before entering the next task. That pause may last only a breath or two, but it matters because it lowers spillover. One project stops contaminating the next. When motivation drops, you do not need a grand rescue. You need a smaller doorway. The minimum viable next step is the smallest useful move that still counts. Open the document. Write one sentence. Review one line. Small here is not a trick. Small is what lets momentum restart when the full size of the task is exactly what keeps you from beginning.
Recovery works the same way. A real break restores attention. It does not just replace one stream of input with another. Standing up, looking away from the screen, taking a few quiet breaths, or moving a little asks less of your mind than opening another feed or another inbox. The latter can feel like relief because the task changes. Your attention is still processing incoming material. That is stimulation, not recovery. There is also a useful pause between kinds of work. Before you move from deep work to lighter tasks, take an unwind and sort moment. Mark what you finished. Note what remains. Name the next reentry point. That brief reset keeps one project from trailing into the next hour, and asking for background attention it no longer needs.
These boundaries matter even more when work and home occupy the same devices and the same rooms. Remote and hybrid work can bring benefits when workload, ergonomics, boundaries, and support are well designed. It can also amplify risk when cues that separate work from non-work weaken. Without that structure, the workday expands. Fragmented schedules push focused work into early mornings, evenings, and weekends that would otherwise support recovery. That is the infinite workday problem. Even after the official stop time, work remains psychologically present. The devices are still there. The threads are still open. Your mind stays in monitoring mode.
This is where the shutdown ritual earns its place in the latch loop. A shutdown is not just the moment you stop typing. It is the sequence that tells your mind it no longer has to keep watch. You start with a firm stop time that is realistic enough to keep. You make it visible through your calendar, your status, a lightweight availability note, or simple team norms. Then you clear the day in a consistent order. Capture the open loops that are still active. Record tomorrow's first next action. Close or label the active items you were using. Park decisions that are not ready. Confirm what can wait. By the time you stand up, tomorrow has an entry point, and today does not need to stay open in your head.
The final minutes matter more than they seem. If you let them fill with fresh requests, the ending disappears, and monitoring starts again. A no new asks boundary protects those minutes for closing, not reopening. It can be simple. You do not start a new thread in the last stretch of the day unless it is truly necessary. And you do not volunteer yourself for another round of fragmented coordination when you are trying to stop.
In a small or shared space, the shutdown also needs a physical edge. Close the laptop, put the notebook away, slide work materials out of sight.
The action is ordinary, but it gives the room a new meaning again. Follow it with a short transition cue, like a walk, a change of clothes, or a brief offline activity. The cue is not decoration. It helps you stop scanning for the next demand. Personal rituals go further when the surrounding culture does not reward constant reachability. Teams reduce that friction when response expectations are clearer, channels are used more deliberately, and immediate availability is not treated as proof of commitment. Sustainable productivity becomes easier when the environment stops manufacturing unnecessary urgency.
You can see the whole pattern in a familiar late-day moment. A brainstorm runs long. The deadline comes back into view. Panic starts to suggest that the only responsible choice is to stay online all night. Instead, you reduce the scale of the next move. You capture the open loop. You decide the first step for tomorrow. You do the smallest useful piece you can, then stop with a clean reentry point. The problem is not magically solved. It is no longer shapeless. That gives you a practice you can use right away. Write the looping thought in one sentence. Choose the next smallest action. Do 2 minutes of it. Then record tomorrow's first next action.
As the week moves forward, you can ask which task matching pattern and which shutdown boundary reduce fatigue most reliably. The question is quieter than a promise to become endlessly disciplined. It is also more useful because it helps you design a day that protects attention, matches effort to capacity, and lets work end cleanly enough for recovery to begin. The next step turns that recovery into an operating condition, with restorative blocks, buffers, and a short weekly reset built to restart the loop after a rough stretch.
In many workdays, you may not have recovery built in. Breaks arrive late, after overload, after a preventable mistake, or when exhaustion is already shaping the quality of your work. That makes recovery reactive. A more sustainable pattern puts recovery inside the design of the day. It is not a reward you earn after strain. It is one of the conditions that lets you keep doing good work.
A key distinction matters here. Switching is not the same as recovering. When you move from a demanding spreadsheet to a newsfeed, or from focused writing to non-urgent messages, the subject changes, but the mind often stays activated. Your attention keeps sorting signals, making small decisions, and holding unfinished work in place. Recovery lowers that load. It gives attention a quieter target, or no target at all, so energy can return instead of simply shifting from one kind of input to another.
Most restorative blocks aim at a few clear outcomes. You may need quiet attention. You may need light movement after too much sitting. You may need brief social connection, a sensory reset, or planning clarity. Planning clarity is easy to confuse with administration, so it helps to draw a clean line. Planning clarity is a short reset that makes the next step visible. It is not an inbox sweep or a long task list cleanup.
A workable rhythm usually has anchors at the start of the day, in the middle, and at the end. The order matters less than the fact that the blocks are named and protected before the week fills with demands. When they sit on the calendar early, they are less likely to disappear under someone else's urgency. A restorative block should also be concrete enough to survive a real workday. Name the activity, give it a clear start, give it a clear end, and keep the duration realistic. 15 minutes walking around the block counts. 10 minutes sitting quietly away from a screen counts. The point is not grandeur. The point is that the block is credible, bounded, and easy to begin.
What does not count as restoration is administrative cleanup dressed up as rest. Clearing messages, sorting files, and updating task lists may be useful, but they keep you in an analytical and monitoring state. If you need planning clarity, keep that block narrow. Decide the next action. Confirm the next focus block. Then stop.
Restorative blocks also work better when focus blocks and communication windows act like bookends around them. Focus gives the work a container before you step away. A communication window after the break gives messages a place to go, so the break does not get replaced by checking. When you know there is a defined time to look at email or chat, you can leave them alone for a short block without feeling that you are abandoning the day.
Small buffers help for the same reason. When meetings, focus blocks, communication windows, and shutdowns sit back to back, the transition cost may not show up on the calendar, but it accumulates in your mind. Even a 5-minute buffer can let working memory unload the last task before the next one begins. The day feels less jagged, and the next block starts cleaner. Over time, repeated cues make recovery easier to enter. Closing your tabs, pouring a glass of water, or stepping out to look at the horizon can signal that a different kind of block is beginning. The cue does not need to be elaborate. It needs to be repeatable, so your mind stops treating every open minute as another chance to absorb input.
Whether recovery is possible is not only an individual question. Workplace norms shape it. Expectations about constant availability, the volume of meetings, and the amount of work assigned all determine how much room recovery actually has. If responsiveness is treated as proof of commitment, then every personal boundary has to fight the culture around it. That is why recovery is increasingly treated as part of work design, rather than a personal perk.
A 2025 study in oncology and hematology nursing, together with the American Psychological Association's Work in America survey in the United States, both align with this design view. This is general research discussion, not medical advice. That nursing research connected poorly designed shift patterns with higher burnout risk, and it linked restorative scheduling and clearer institutional recognition of staff needs with lower burnout risk and higher job satisfaction. The Work in America survey reported that 4-day workweek arrangements have grown in adoption, and trials often describe improvements in well-being and retention. Even so, the evidence base is still evolving, and recovery does not require a full redesigned workweek before it can begin.
Smaller protected blocks can still reduce daily overload. A short walk at midday can change the texture of your last focus stretch. A brief, quiet reset before the final work block can make the day feel less fragmented. A defined decompression block at the end of the day can shift the quality of what follows stop time. Recovery becomes real when part of the system changes enough for attention and energy to come back. This is the full logic of the latch loop. Focus projects choose the work that matters. Communication rules protect attention from unnecessary switching. Capacity matching helps you avoid forcing the wrong task at the wrong energy level. The shutdown ritual closes the day cleanly. Restorative scheduling makes the pattern repeatable, not fragile.
To keep the system working, a short weekly review helps more than another promise to try harder. The review is maintenance, not a performance audit. You ask which outcome mattered most and whether it received protected attention. You ask which communication rule reduced switching and which one still needs tightening. You ask when your energy ran highest, lowest, and most recoverable. You ask whether the stop time held and what made it easier or harder to keep. You ask which restorative block actually restored you and which one only distracted you.
Those questions matter because the review should change next week's structure. You choose an outcome. You tighten one communication friction rule. You check the energy patterns you can already see. You confirm the daily stop time. Then, you place recovery on the calendar before other demands fill the space. The match determines whether a block feels restorative. If the strain comes from analysis and mental clutter, quiet attention or a sensory reset may fit better than more conversation. After a run of meetings, light movement or brief social connection may do more good than another screen time stretch. If planning clarity is the right move, you keep it brief and you protect it from creeping into administration.
Some weeks still come apart. When they do,
restart small. Return to one focus project, one communication rule, one shutdown note, and one restorative block. Systems fail under the weight of their own ideal version, so a smaller loop is easier to re-enter. Re-entry is what keeps the practice alive. You can see the effect in an ordinary afternoon. Fatigue rises, and the reflex is to push through one more task. If a restorative appointment is already on the calendar, you do something different. You step away before exhaustion peaks. 15 minutes of quiet movement can make the final focus stretch steadier and often more useful than another 15 minutes of depleted effort. You can test the idea quickly. Find one open space today or tomorrow. Name one restorative block that matches what you need. Give it a clear start and end. Protect it with one communication boundary, even if that boundary is simply muting notifications for the duration. Then keep one closing question in view. Which restorative block can you protect most reliably this week? Once recovery has a real place in the schedule, the rest of the loop has somewhere to land. Your workday can end with tomorrow's first action visible. Attention stops leaking into every channel. Recovery sits on the calendar before exhaustion decides for you. You choose what matters. Protect your attention, recover your energy, and close the day cleanly enough to begin again.
Suggested further reading. If you want to keep the momentum going with evidence and practical framing, start with Asana's Anatomy of Work Index. It usefully quantifies the work-about-work drain, time spent chasing updates in unnecessary meetings, on duplicative effort, and in status talk, so you can see in numbers why protecting focus is often a design problem, not a personal willpower problem. For the boundary collapse angle, Microsoft's Work Trend Index is a go-to explainer. It tracks patterns like the infinite workday, day-to-day chaos, and after-hours digital activity, helping you connect your lived experience to broader workplace dynamics.
To dig into the attention side of the bottleneck, look for the Institute for Organizational Mindfulness's 2024 synthesis on attention as today's productivity gap. You'll find an accessible, research-grounded bridge between cognitive switching costs, mental fatigue, and why high-signal work needs predictable conditions, especially in notification-heavy environments. For meeting design as a lever, MIT Sloan Management Review's coverage of No Meeting Days is especially listener-friendly. It describes organizational experiments, what improved when teams blocked real focus time, and the common sweet spot where eliminating all meetings entirely can be counterproductive.
For recovery as an operating condition, the Global Wellness Institute's 2025 Workplace Well-Being Work is worth your attention, because it doesn't treat rest as a perk. It treats recovery as a performance strategy, with examples of how organizations build restorative scheduling into normal operations. And if you work in hybrid or remote settings and want the health and performance evidence in one place, seek out the 2023 peer-reviewed systematic review on remote work's physical and psychological impacts. It's useful for understanding both risks like fatigue, sleep disruption, and musculoskeletal strain, and the conditions under which remote work can support well-being.
This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.